This is the third program on the Native Arts and Literature Conference that was held last December at Sitka. I'm Mo Osley, and welcome to Potlatch. Sarah Del Ard Fredericks of the University of Alaska in Anchorage told of some experiences in art appreciation and education to those assembled at the Centennial Building at Sitka.
I was teaching an art appreciation course, and a young girl from Point Hope came up to me and said, "I don't know what to write my term paper about." And I said, "Where are you from?" And she said, "Point Hope." I said, "Do you know about the Richard Puatak finds from your own town?" "No." And I said, "Well, why don't you write your term paper about that?" And she did, and she came back to me a number of times, just starry-eyed. And finally, she said, "You know, I remember my grandmother talked about a Professor Rainey." And of course, Larson and Rainey were the two archaeologists who did the excavations at Point Hope and uncovered, really, one of the greatest artistic finds that we have in all of Alaska. It is equivalent to King Tut's tomb, which was discovered in Egypt. And it's been written up extensively, yet this girl had grown up there, not knowing anything about what had been dug out of the ground just a few miles from where she lived. I think to have this kind of an education in the schools is a necessity. I went to the state-operated schools some 5 years ago, talked to the top authorities and tried to get them to start a program of this sort. To my knowledge, little or nothing was ever done. I'm hoping that you people here will do something about that. The second great need that I see is for more inclusion of Alaskan Native arts in world histories of art. And when you look at the World History of Art books that are coming out today, at least there's a slight improvement. There may be two or three pages now. But this is an important segment of world history of art that should be recognized and amplified in future publications. And I've thought a number of times today and yesterday about the famous French quotation to the effect that the only thing permanent is change itself. And what we're seeing and hearing are evidences of changes within the culture. I'm personally excited about the creativity, the change that is taking place in Eskimo art in particular. And what you have seen here has been largely the result of creativity among the Eskimos. We had one excellent example in an Aleut, Fred Anderson, who's doing innovative work. I miss the Tlingit and Haida artists, and I'd like to see more creativity coming out of them, because I think they are just as capable of producing creative art today as they were during the period when they produced the great totems.
Bob Callahan of the Turtle Island Foundation in California is a writer and printer who wrote and read an introduction to a book about the Pitt River Indians of Northwest California. It is a book that was written by Dean Gulu.
Winter comes early to Alturas. The snow begins to fall in early October, and the long Arctic winters stay until the last days of March. The Pitt River Indians have lived on that barren, forbidding plateau in northeastern California for thousands of years. The snow people. That's what the Modoc call them. In the old days, with the first flakes of winter, the Indians would climb down through the smoke hole into the winter lodges. Inside the lodge, dug into the ground, the roof covered with earth, it was warm even with a small fire. "Yet you have to be an Indian," Jaime D'Angulo writes, "to stand the crowding, the lack of privacy, the eternal squabbling of babies." And after a few months of occupancy, the vermin was terrible. Once in a while, someone would take out the old litter and bring in a fresh supply of pine boughs. But the fleas, lice, cockroaches, and other bugs soon returned and made life once more a misery. People sighed for the coming of spring and quarreled as to what month they were in. The old chiefs were consulted, but they disagreed. And so winter passed. In those days, the Pitt River Indians didn't really have much of what we would call culture. Their baskets were second rate, the patterns too blurred, too crude. No skin painting, nothing at all unusual about their dress. Even their dancing was inferior, stiff, awkward, too rapid. Singing was about the only form of art developed by those Indians, the Angulo writes. Singing and old time stories. Jaime de Angulo bought a cattle ranch in Alturas in 1913. Dr. Jaime de Angulo, the son of a Spanish don, de Angulo came to America at the age of 18 and worked his way out west as a cowboy, taking odd jobs on ranches in Wyoming and Colorado. He arrived in San Francisco just in time for the earthquake of 1906. In San Francisco, he began to study medicine at the former Cooper Medical College, Cooper then to Johns Hopkins, where he received his first medical degree in 1912. The next year, de Angulo became a partner in the ranch and met the Pitt River people for the very first time. His introduction was cut short, however, by the outbreak of the First World War. De Angulo volunteered for service, and before long, he was sent to Ann Arbor to attend an early course on psychiatry for Army doctors. He graduated, then stayed on as an instructor at the school for the remainder of the war. Back at the ranch a few months later, de Angulo decided to drive a herd of horses down from the plateau through the long 500-mile Central Valley to new homestead land in the Big Sur. He was living on the new land in the summer of 1919 when two college professors, Alfred Kroeber and Paul Radin, rented a cabin nearby. During the next few months, the three men became close friends, and by the end of the summer, de Angulo had accepted Kroeber's invitation to join him at the university the next year. So, in 1920, Jaime de Angulo left cattle ranching for a while and taught his first two courses in Berkeley, one in Jungian psychiatry, the other on the mind of primitive man. De Angulo helped inaugurate the golden age of American anthropology at Cal, and that's the University of California, Berkeley. Kroeber and Radin were already in residence when he arrived. Robert Lowy, Carl O. Sauer, and briefly, Edward Sapir would also join the staff by the end of the decade. Jaime de Angulo's presence alone, one suspects, would have been enough. His wonderful ear for language quickened the environment. In the company of these men, he expanded his interests 17 new languages during the next 15 years. Chatino, Chichimeco, Chichateco, Choco, Chanto, Mazateco, Mixe, Tequisletec, and Zapotec proper, the Indians of Mexico. Karak, Klamath, Modoc, Miwok, Paiute, Pomo, Shastan, and Achimawi, the Indians of Northern California. He even managed to translate Lao Tzu with the help of only a small pocket dictionary. But de Angulo began with Achimawi, the spoken language of his former Pitt River friends. In 1921, he returned once more to Alturas, this time to record the grammar and the literature of his chosen tribe. In the beginning was the word. The stories, he felt, dated back into the furthest reaches of the Stone Age, were more ancient than myth. And the word was with God. In these stories, he felt he had found one of man's earliest attempts to make articulate the movement of the spirit. And the word was God. Quote, the symbolism in these stories is so crude and so little disguised that it can't really be considered symbolism at all. In this early stage of civilization, ideas are still immanent in objects and have not yet been separated, either through identification or projection. Speaking as a Jungian there. In these stories, we find the Tinahawi, the primitive religious spirit, reflected throughout. And yet, the reader might ask, if the Pitt River Indians have no religious ceremonies, no priesthood, no ritual of any kind, and not the slightest approach to any conception of Godhead, how can one speak of their having any spiritual or religious values? I grant that it may sound paradoxical, but I must answer on the contrary. The life of these Indians is nothing but a continuous religious experience. The spirit of wonder, the recognition of life as power, as a mysterious, ubiquitous, concentrated form of non-material energy, of something loose about the world, and contained in a more or less condensed degree by every object. This is the credo of the Pitt River Indian. Of course, they would not put it precisely this way. The phraseology is mine, but it is not far from their own.
Well,
was Jane Oliver. Poet Nathaniel Tarn journeyed from the East Coast by car to Alaska, and he recites several poems that he wrote while he was here.
Pow, here is the great American promised land with mountains of light bursting apart in the clear air, light on light, and pow, the gates at whatever cents an acre from the Russians, the clear air shot with mountain bluebirds, the bluest bluebirds ever, the purest air, a mystery of mountains where Canada ends, gate after gate as the sun slants. Land of no night, gone beyond where night is known, past the hot Liard, rush of Yukon, 2,000 miles into the Bering Sea, all your peoples north crying, we want moose, we want bear, want wolverine, trickster, hard over St. Elias on the other side of the crest, Yakutat, friendly Tlingit, want green over this, want snows in summer, queen of the Yukon, sister to the spirit, disappeared forever among eagles, snowdrift, among snowbirths. Mist over the lake, 1,000 miles of dust, settled into Lake Kluane, sinks to the bottom, no sediment, weariness dropping off like horns, antlers, presenting oneself cleansed by the long journey at the great land's gates. Three doll sheep, pure ivory, high on Sheep Mountain, as if by royal command. We climb into woolen pants against the zero, into the van now baptized, the Yukon Ritz, drinking Moskovskaya 100 degrees on Alaska's doorsteps. Dashboard table against the cold, summer foods, bread, mayonnaise, tomato, cucumber, scallions, cheeses, banana, broccoli, central heating vodka against the cold, outside, thrashed by the wind, catkins not seen so thick since Arctic Russia, their woolen outerwear, blue lupins, who would have known as well that Alaska would be full of swallows? What passes for a poet up here is Robert Service. They probably needed you, William Wordsworth, with a dash of Whitman in you, and the bones of some unknown poet, Siberian shaman perhaps, St. Lawrence Yupik. Notes made against the cold for an ode to WW in the great land. Morning and sun after the storm. Ice pushed against shore by waves, ice crystal waves. The blue is astonishing, like a knife cut. Two pair of red-breasted mergansers close into shore, then rapid flight against the ice. Spirit of the North, the path zips open, pow, trip totems found. From the top of the tree, where I had climbed in hope of what, I asked, the skull at the top of the spine, ravens at both windows pecking me out. We fell out of Alaska in a rush of rain, flushed out by cataracts, unending rushes of water, greening the pines and ferns into the sun-drenched fruit bowls. After 3 weeks of rain, no longer sure of the outlines of leaping fish or mountains, smoking at dawn as mist burns off, common or garden sunlight is like a God gift. Raven? On the last day up there, at the top of the tree, drank wine on a big Englishman, bought the flag of Alaska, found some antique ivory, and after beer and love, for the first time in our joint lives, we danced in Ketchikan.
Conductor says play, we all do what he say, we're all playing the same song as you. Sway when you walk, you even sing when you talk, you're a rare rhapsody and a sincere symphony. Oh,
Denali was our greatest animal. We might never have seen it, doubted all reports, never realized why it was unmistakably Lord of America. It rose when it rose, two whole days out of surrounding mountains, like the sun's ghost after a burial at sea, like the white whale out of the sea, defining all else immediately. Almost a painting, that unreal as when they say postcards, etc., or travel poster. Archetype of all the mountains behind the mind lurking, no, they say of a beast lurking, animal negative, and we talk of gods. Always there against the epiphany. White ship of space, rootless, suspended from the clouds, sometimes the whole sky gray, the crown floating by itself in the skies, or clouds on its face, recessing it into immeasurable farness, or lifting it, the mountain, depressing it according to the play of cloud, the Leela. A resurrection, de mortuis, from the death of our senses in its shroud, which is also a wedding gown, bride, bridegroom in one plenitude, knowing or not the plenitude, there is no other question. That we could have been again encamped with most of humanity at the foot and spent days, days, weeks even, and not seen it, as so many coming all this way, these 1,000 miles for a short time on little money, their poor lives spent at the gates now, and still not seen it. This beats all matters of election. When thus the mountain rose, and the traveler, disbelieving, who had said all along the way, is this Denali? And then this, and this, and this, there being no end to the mountains, but patient, there being always a step below perfection, until at road curve, oh my God, hushed, and the other not seeing yet, and then the other also, oh my God, and in a still greater hush, because now there was no possible mistaking. Great star of space, de mortuis, complete in its motionless travels, even then at its destination, never yet gone from Earth, its mother, we might not have seen it, never have looked on God's face and lived so far to tell tales. Had we not seen it, the world would have always forever thereafter, and its word, logos, seemed smaller, because after the moon, after all, it is never the same again, an earthly thing has to be great indeed, perfect indeed, to give that plenitude, that lack of argument tells us we have looked on God's face and lived so far to tell tales. And had we not seen this, would not have seen either in any sense of the word seen, since only this mountain gave the world eyes and senses to apprehend it with. Catalog, world model, oh, the cinnamon mountains, all the other mountains in all their varied glory, the heaving bears with the earth like Atlas on their shoulders, the wolves running as fast as cars, the idiot ptarmigan posing at roadside, the payroll animals bowing at each bus, the tourists screaming. Continue at own leisure. My minute preoccupations under Denali. Horned lark, American first, eagle, repeat, but immature, wheatear, American first, ptarmigan, American first, continue as per notebook, list climbing, X percent of total record, but the invisibles, harlequin duck, later St. Paul, Arctic warbler, later Point Hope, golden plover, later Shishmaref, all these waiting for the next time, the world being in place, no problem, and then seen again and again from turn again arm, from the plain, back from the Pribilofs, from the roadside, back from Fairbanks, as if it were a friend now and reluctant to leave. And the great animal, even greater than this animal, Denali, god-beast, god-animal, with hips of stone and rock haunches, waiting for the next time also to get us before another sighting, another chance at the vicinity, but we have seen it, and then by implication also the other as black as it is white. Cloud of mosquitoes, splat, blood on hands and face and clothes, wolf blood, moose blood, bear blood, bird blood, perhaps John Doe from Texas or Oklahoma blood, the, quote, animals, unquote. What a merger in the sight of the whole! Outside the park, every signpost in Alaska is riddled with bullet holes. Back into civilization. The world has fallen down. We are the only ones who remember how it was made, put together. Entering night again, we must hold on to each other. No other memory is left. Alone, we are the plan, time's grid, and no one else survives. Like the sea's whisper is the great land's name in our ears, Alaska, like the shape of waves, its mountain shapes, Alaska, distantly haunted, we remember its beauty, the noise of the glaciers folding their arms.
My life was so simple in my younger days, past the time in such carefree ways. Mom and Dad were always there. Wide-eyed youth, too bad I learned the truth. How I wish that I was young again and free. How I wish that I was young again and free. Coaster breaks and flat tire fakes in grammar school. Sister always led the way, laying down the road. Out in the yard, he played so hard, me, I was so cool. Wide-eyed youth, too bad I learned the truth. How I wish that I was young again and free. How I wish that I young again and free. Younger days, in so many ways they're calling me. Life is such a fleeting thing, it pushing me. I tried to make the best of it. Dream I see the pressure falling everywhere I long to be. Wide-eyed youth, too bad I learned the truth. How I wish that I was young again and free. How I wish that I was young again and free.
Music by Herb Peterson. Our final segment features Jim Pepper, a composer of Native American music from California. He sings the Kaw Indian song.
I'm not one to hold, you're not me. Yum no ho, yum na ne, yum na wa no ho, yum na ne, and then no way. Tanto, give me wa, honey go run, eh, yon na ne no, with you tanto, give me wa, honey go run, eh, honey go run, eh, honey go run, eh, with you tanto, give me wa, honey go run, eh, yon na ne no way. With you tanto, give me wa, with you tanto, give me wa, with you tanto, give me wa, honey go run, eh, yon na ne no, with you tanto. Honey go runny, honey go runny, honey go runny, would you tanto give me wow? Honey go runny, yana, hene no way. Pio te winda, yana wanna ho, pio te winda, yana wanna ho, yana ne, hene no way. Pio te winda, yana wanna ho, yana ne, hene no way.
I'm Mo Osley, and thank you for listening to program number 3 on the Native Arts and Literature Conference.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.